you because I'm really the guest here. But it's good to see all of you. I've met some of you in Cincinnati before. I met Mr. Grove out there in Cincinnati. I didn't recognize him with a tie on. Last time I saw him, he was in stripes. So it's good to see him again. I know I've seen some of you in some of, I was going to say y'all, some of y'all in Cincinnati. I'm from Texas. But it's good to see all of you again. I'd like to welcome all the people that are listening by Cybercast. I'd like to welcome all of you, and I would encourage you to, I guess, tune in would be the correct term, back at 3 o'clock. Let me tell you a little bit about what's going to happen this afternoon. This afternoon I'm going to be giving you a seminar on Noah's Ark and the Genesis flood, and a little bit, I'm going to touch on a little bit about the fossil record of early man. And that's going to last about, an hour and a half, maybe an hour and 25, 30 minutes. And I've got a bunch of models up here displayed, some sedimentary rocks, some fossils, and different things. I'll be talking about that. And then we'll have a short pause and let people kind of stretch their legs, and then we'll have some question and answers that you'll be able to ask. So I just wanted the people who are listening in by Cybercast to know that if they come back at 3 o'clock, they'll be able to hear all of that. And I think that you will be, you will like the presentation. I find that most people think it's very interesting, especially my wife and daughter. They have to say that because they, you know, fly back with me and everything. But just would like to welcome, or like to ask all of you to come back at 3 o'clock for that. I think that services should be over here in about an hour and 15, 20 minutes, and then we'll come back here at 3 o'clock. So once again, thank all of you for inviting me to be here, for making the arrangements for me to be here. I'd like to thank the Cubics for hosting me and my wife. My wife eats a lot of food, and so they're really having to struggle through this, but I'd like to thank them for inviting us and hosting us and taking care of us and making all the arrangements to be able for us to be here to present this to you. You know, when young people often meet their friends, one of the questions they'll often ask is, where are you from? Another thing that they will often ask is, where were you born? And then along with those kinds of questions comes questions like, where are your parents from? And these are all questions we often ask our new friends because we are all interested in our origins. We're all interested in where people have come from, and they're interested in where we've come from. And other questions that we might ask that kind of tie in with this in a more general scientific way are, where did the world come from? Where did the Earth and its biosphere come from? Where did all the different life forms that inhabit the Earth, where did they come from? Where did we, humanity, where did we come from? Did we evolve? Many people believe that the theory of evolution answers all those questions. Did we evolve? Is evolution the process that created us? Because either evolution created us, and we're here because of evolution, or there's a God and God has created us. Because there are two mutually exclusive points of view or philosophy. So is another question we might ask is evolution scientific? Well, sure, you'd say, of course it's scientific. All the scientists, most of them, believe in evolution and believe that's how we got here. So it's got to be scientific. Well, you know, the Bible has much to say about all these questions that I've given you. It's got a lot to say about whether evolution is correct or not and about where we originated. So today what we're going to do is we're going to look at what the Bible says about our origins. We're going to look at that. We're going to see where we originated, how the theory of evolution violates multiple hundreds of laws of science, and how evolution, although unprovable, affects you. Now you may say, no, I don't teach at a university. I don't read the scientific journal articles. I'm not doing any kind of scientific research. I'm not an anthropologist. That doesn't affect me. But I'm here to tell you that whether you believe it or not, evolution affects you, it affects the things you allow into your mind, and it affects, to a certain extent, how we think, because we are all a product of the society and the culture we live in, and so it does affect us. Now, though some of you like to write notes, so if you'd like to write notes, let me give you my first point. First point is that evolution is supported by the media because it is socially popular. It allows people to do what I call their own thing. It's not popular because it's scientific. It's popular because if you believe in evolution, then there's no God. And if there's no God, you can do whatever you want. And that's the main reason that evolution is so popular. Evolution allows people to live as they please without anyone telling them, without any higher authority telling them what they must do. And science, and this statement is always a little strange and interesting to people, science has always been used by society to reinforce what is culturally popular at the time. Always has been, always will be, because science is part of this culture. Let me ask you a question, ladies. Statistically, 50% of us in here are ladies. If you were alive back in 1910, 1905, turn of the 1800s, as we were going to the 19th century, do you know, and I'm being a little tongue-in-cheek here, but do you know that there was scientific evidence to prove why you should not be allowed to vote? You know, men just didn't, on their own, come up and say, you know, we're going to be brutes, and we're not going to allow the gentle gender to vote because we just want to do what we want to do, and we want to keep them out of the system. Now, it could have been because of that, but there was scientific evidence, put that in quotes, to show why women, why minorities, and why people of certain ethnic backgrounds should not vote and should not be allowed to immigrate into the country. Let me give you an example. Adolf Hitler was a firm believer in evolution. So were most of your despots of the 19th and the 20th century. They believed in evolution. And Adolf Hitler believed in evolution. And all Adolf Hitler did was he took evolution and he accelerated it politically and culturally. He said, we are the master race. There are inferior races, and we are going to eliminate the inferior races. We don't have time to wait for evolution to act. We're going to do it. And as a result, about 60 million people died. About 60 million people died. There's a certain science that's called eugenics. If you've ever studied eugenics, it's a very interesting topic to study. And eugenics was popular in the early 1900s. And the study of eugenics, or the science of eugenics, and it was a very hardcore science at the time, allowed society to suppress those that were not as cultural, of the proper social standing, and of the right racial background. Let me read you a quote. I'm going to be doing a little bit of reading in this sermon because it sort of lends itself to reading. But let me read you what it says in the Encyclopedia Britannica under the heading eugenics. This is the Encyclopedia Britannica, 1984. Eugenics. The American Eugenics Society, founded in 1926, supported the proposition that the wealth and social position of the upper class was justified by a superior genetic endowment. They believed that people were superior genetic stock. The question you might ask is, how did they determine this? Okay, keep that thought in mind as I keep reading. U.S. eugenists also supported restrictions on immigrations from nations with inferior stock, such as Italy, Greece, and countries of Eastern Europe, and argued for the sterilization of insane, retarded, and epileptic citizens in the United States. As a result of their efforts, sterilization laws were passed in more than half of the United States, and isolated instances of involuntary sterilization continued in the 1970s. Now, I'm still reading out of the Britannic article. The assumptions of eugenics came under sharp criticism beginning in the 1930s and were discredited after the German Nazis used eugenics to support the exterminations of Jews, blacks, and homosexuals. That's what Adolf Hitler did with eugenics. Now, there's a certain book that's been written. This has been written by Stephen Jay Gould. If you do any kind of reading of evolutionary literature or any kind of scientific literature, Stephen Jay Gould is a pillar in the scientific community. He's written a lot of evolutionary books. He's written probably hundreds of articles, journal articles, that have appeared in peer review articles such as Nature, Science, Scientific American, and he's an evolutionist. Through and through, he's an evolutionist. I'd like to read you what he says in this book. This is The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould. And in this book, it brings up the concept of craniometry. cranial skulls metry measurement, the measuring of skulls. You remember I asked you how the eugenist figured out who was more genetically superior and therefore who should be included and who should be excluded? It had to do with craniometry. And actually, craniometry was a very very interesting science back in the late, in the early 1900s and the late 1800s. Now, let me read you what it says in this introduction of this book on page 2122. This is The Mismeasure of Man, published by W.W. Norton & Company, New York, in 1993. Introduction, page 21 through 22. Science, since people must do it, is a socially embedded activity. Do you remember that I told you that science has been used, or evolution has been used, to support what is culturally popular at the time? Science plays into that. And I don't want to, you know, paint science with all the same brush, but your historical scientists, your evolutionists, your anthropologists, the people that will dig up fossils and attribute the origins of men in a certain fashion, those are the type of people I'm talking about. Science, as people must do it, is a socially embedded activity. It progresses by hunch, vision, and intuition. Now, you've always been told that scientists, look, just give me the facts, ma'am. Just give me the facts. Facts without interpretation are nothing. Every branch of science interprets facts. The evolutionary branch is no different. Much of its change, reading again, much of its change through time does not record a closer approach to absolute truth, but the alteration of cultural contexts that influence it so strongly. Facts are not pure and unsullied bits of information. Culture also influences what we see and how we see it. Theories, moreover, are not inexorable inductions from facts. The most creative theories are often imaginative visions imposed upon facts. The source of imagination is also strongly cultural. Facts are subject to your interpretation, they're subject to your preconceived notions, and they're subject to the culture you live in, the interpretation of those facts. Chapter 3, same book, Measuring Heads, page 80 through 82. Listen to this statement. Prior prejudice, not copious numerical documentation, dictates conclusions. If you believe that we are being visited by aliens from another galaxy, you are going to interpret the facts to support that, even if we aren't, because you're going to see it through your lens, your mind's eye, the lens that you have, that preconceived notion. And everybody is prejudiced. Everybody. We can scarcely doubt, reading again, that Beans, now Bean was an early craniometrist researcher. Now let me kind of give you a little bit of trivia here. You've all heard the statement, what's your boss like? Oh, he's a real bean counter. And you've heard that? You know, you ever wondered where that came from? Well, Bean was a researcher that formulated a lot of the theories behind craniometry. And what Bean did is he would take a skull. He would turn the skull over upside down. He would fill the skull with lead shot or with beans. And he would pour them out into a container. And he would measure how many cc's or milliliters of lead shot was in your head. And if you had more lead shot, obviously you had more brains. And if you had more brains, you were of those that were of superior genetics. You see, all you were doing was looking at data, right? And they used this, ladies, to show that you should not vote back 80, 90 years ago, 100 years ago. Let me keep reading. So that's where the term, he's a bean counter, came from. His name was Bean, and he literally counted beans. It's kind of a little trivia there. All right, now, we can scarcely doubt that Beans, earlier researcher in craniometry, statements about blacks reflected a prior belief that he set out to objectify, not an induction from data about fronts and backs of brains. Bean believed that people of minority races weren't as genetically endowed as other people. And because he believed that, the interpretations he put on facts supported that. That's what he's saying here. And, I'm reading again, and the special pleading that yielded black inferiority from equality of brain size is ludicrous outside a shared context of a prior belief in the inferiority of blacks. Numbers and graphs do not gain authority from increasing precision of measurement. sample size of complexity and manipulation. Basic experimental designs may be flawed, subject to the correction by extended repetition. Prior commitment to one among many potential conclusions often guarantees a serious flaw in design. Craniometry was not just a plaything of academians, a subject confined to technical journals. Conclusions flooded the popular press. Once entrenched, they often embarked on a life of their own, endlessly copied from secondary source to secondary source. Now, it begins to talk about Moll. Moll was an opponent of Bean. Moll had different ideas and came to different conclusions than Bean did. Moll, a scientific opponent of Bean, nipped the dogma in the bud, and we'll get into that in a minute, but not before a leading journal, now this is a scientific journal, had recommended that blacks be barred from voting as a consequence of their innate stupidity. But Franklin P. Moll, Bean's mentor at Johns Hopkins, talking about Johns Hopkins University here, very prestigious university and medical clinic. Bean's mentor at Johns Hopkins became suspicious. Bean's data were too good. In other words, it agreed too perfectly with his assumptions. He repeated Bean's work, but with an important difference in procedure. What do you think he did that made all the difference? He repeated Bean's work, but with an important difference in procedure. He made sure he did not know which crania were from blacks and which were from whites until after he measured them. And guess what? From a sample of 106 brains using Bean's methods of measurements, he found no difference between whites and blacks and the relative size of their brains. And I like to tell this story. I have three children. One of them, Virginia, is with me here today. But actually, my wife has had three children. We have three children. The middle one is Adam. Got to give her credit. The middle one is Adam. Adam is 21 years old. I was there when all my children were born. I was there when Adam was born. He's 21. And they look like lizards. They don't get pretty and handsome till about 3 or 4 days later. So this baby comes out, and the nurse who's there, we should have paid the nurse, not the doctor, but the nurse that was there gave me the baby and said, go measure your son, go weigh him, go, you know, length and all that stuff. Whatever you put down is what we're going to write. I said, okay, it's not hard to do. So I take him over there, I put him on the scale, and the scale's, you know, doing one of this, back and forth, and it's at 8 pounds, 15 ounces, 9 pounds, 1 ounce, 8 pounds, 50. I get to decide. I get to decide what my son's going to weigh. Now, if you've ever been around, my wife is a petite woman, if you've ever been around church ladies, how was the baby? Oh, it was fine. What did he weigh? He weighed 9 pounds. 9 pounds? So to spare my wife that, I put down 8 pounds, 15. I mean, my son, you know, it's in 9.99, right? I put down 8 pounds, 15. So that's the official weight my son Adam has on his birth certificate. You know why? I had a prior prejudice. I didn't want him to weigh 9 pounds. I wanted him to weigh 8 pounds 15, so that's what I wrote, because that's what it said. Prior prejudice. Might not be a big problem when you're measuring your second-born son. But what about when you're measuring cranium, and you're measuring bones, and you're trying to decide whether those bones are human bones or extinct ape bones? Differences, very subtle differences, will collect and add up to different conclusions. Page 85. Still talking about what it says in this book, The Mismeasure of Man by Stephen Jay Gould. Gould is going to tell you what he did. I, Gould, spent a month reading all of Broca's major work. Another craniometrist, Paul Broca, professor of clinical surgery in the Faculty of Medicine at Johns Hopkins. He founded the Anthropological Society of Paris in 1859. The Anthropological Society of Paris lapped up Darwin's theory of the fact that we have descended from the animals. And also ran all over town with Neanderthal skeletons saying that they were from primitive apes and that we had descended from them. This is the background for this gentleman. Okay, he concentrating on a statistical procedure. So we have Gould, the writer of the book, concentrating on these past craniometrist statistical procedures. I found a definite pattern in their methods. He traversed the gap between fact and conclusion by what may be the usual route, predominantly in reverse. Conclusions came first. And Broca's conclusions were the shared assumptions of most successful white males during his time. Themselves on the top by the good fortune of nature. I mean, after all, you're only measuring beans, right? Themselves on the top by the good fortune of nature, and women, blacks, and poor people below. His facts were reliable, but they were gathered selectively and then manipulated unconsciously in the service of prior conclusion. By this route, the conclusions not only achieved the blessings of science, but the prestige of numbers. Broca and his school used facts as illustrations, not as a constraining document, but as illustrations. They began with conclusions, peered through their facts, and came right back to the same conclusions. If you're a person who believes that there's no God, and you're in academia, or you're a scientist, what kind of evidence are you going to find? Are you going to find evidence to support that fact? Are you going to find evidence to support that there is no God or there isn't a God? Which one are you going to support? Think about it. Think about it. We all tend to think, and I'm a scientist, I'm also a creationist, we all tend to think of scientists as being very objective, and they are not. They are extremely biased because, you know, they're human. They're just like you and me. They're human. I'd like to read you an article that is also out of the Encyclopedia Britannica. This is about Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis. Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis was a doctor from Hungary, lived back in the 1800s. And he discovered something very, very interesting. And I want you to notice what the scientific community, how they reacted to his discovery. Ignaz Philipp Semmelweis, German, Hungarian, born in Budapest, Hungary, Austria Empire, in August 13, 1865, German-Hungarian physician who discovered the cause of childbed fever and introduced antiseptics into medical practice. Educated at the universities of Pest and Vienna, Semmelweis received his doctor's degree from Vienna in 1844 and was appointed assistant at the obstetrics clinic in Vienna. He soon became involved in the problem of childbed fever, the scourge of maternity hospitals throughout Europe. Although most women delivered at home, those who had to seek hospitalization because of poverty, illegitimacy, or obstetrical complications faced mortality rates as high as 25 to 30%. If you were a woman and you went to the clinic, there was a 1 in 4, 1 in 3 chance that you weren't coming back. Some thought that this infection was introduced by overcrowding. Others thought poor ventilation. Others the onset of lactation or other factors. Semmelweis proceeded to investigate its causes over the strong objection of his chief, who, like other continental, in other words, European physicians, had reconciled himself to the idea that the disease was unpreventable. Look, Semmelweis, just leave it alone. You're not going to find out what's causing this. We can live with it. Just leave it alone. Semmelweis observed that among women in the first division of the clinic, there was two divisions of the clinic, the death rate from childbed fever was 2 or 3 times as high among those in the second division. Although the two divisions were identical, with the exception that students were taught in the first and midwives in the second. So in this clinic where the students taught, the death rate was very high. In this clinic where the midwives taught, the death rate was very low. Question now becomes, what's the difference? Okay? He put forward the thesis that perhaps the students carried something to the patients they examined during labor. The death of a friend from a wound infection incurred during the examination of a woman who died of this infection, and the similarity of the findings in the two cases gave support to his reasonings. Now listen to this profound statement. Right now we're going to go like, duh. Back then it was very profound. He concluded that students who came directly from the dissecting room to the maternity ward carried the infection from mothers who had died of the disease to healthy mothers. So they're performing the autopsies on these women who died, the students are, and they would come back to the clinic. Guess what was happening? He ordered the students to wash their hands in a solution of chlorinated lime before each examination. Under these procedures, the mortality rates in the first division dropped from 18.27 to 1.0. 0.27%. Went from almost 20% to a little bit more than 1%. Instead of 20 women per 100 dying, now only a little more than one woman per 100 was dying. Just wash your hands. What do you think would happen? Everybody, oh, this is great. Yeah, a great breakthrough here. Let's all implement this. The younger medical men in Vienna recognized the significance of Semmelweis' discovery and gave him all possible assistance. His superior, on the other hand, was critical. In the year 1848, a liberal political revolution swept Europe, and Semmelweis took part in the events in Vienna. Let me kind of stop here. Let me ask you a philosophical question. You ever been discriminated against because of certain philosophical leanings you have? I know I have. There are certain jobs I couldn't get because I have a certain concept about the Sabbath. It has nothing to do with my qualities as a scientist or as a person. It has to do with my belief system. In the year 1848, and I'm sure it's happened to you also, in the year 1848, a liberal political revolution swept Europe, and Semmelweis took part in the events in Vienna. After the revolution had been put down, Semmelweis found that his political activities, not scientific, but political activities, had increased the obstacles to his professional work. In 1849, he was dropped from his post at the clinic. He then applied for a teaching post at the University of Midwifery, but was turned down. Soon after that, he gave a successful lecture at the Medical Society of Vienna entitled The Origin of Childbed Fever. At the same time, he applied once more for a teaching post, but although he received it, there were restrictions attached to it that he considered humiliating. He left Vienna and returned to Pest in 1850. He worked for the next 6 years at St. Rocha's Hospital in Pest. An epidemic of childbed fever had broken out in the obstetrics department, and at his request, Semmelweis was put in charge of the department. Now, we're talking about scientific things here. We're talking about scientists evaluating things objectively. His measures promptly reduced the mortality rate, and in his years there, it averaged only 0.85%. That's less than 1%. In Prague and Vienna, meantime, the rate was still from 10 to 15%. People were dying because they didn't want to wash their hands. In 1855, he was appointed professor of obstetrics at the University of Pest. He married, had 5 children, and developed his private practice. His ideas were accepted in Hungary, and the government addressed a circular to all district authorities ordering the introduction of Semmelweis' methods. In 1857, he declined the chair of obstetrics at the University of Zurich. Vienna remained hostile towards him. And the editor of a certain prestigious German medical journal wrote that it was time to stop the nonsense about the chlorine hand wash. In 1861, Semmelweis published his principal work, Understanding and Prevention of Childbed Fever. He sent it to all prominent obstetricians and medical societies abroad, but the general reaction was adverse. The weight of authority stood against his teachings. He addressed several open letters to professors of medicine in other countries, but to little effect. At a conference of German physicians and natural scientists, we're talking about doctors and scientists, most of the speakers, including the pathologist Rudolf Virchow, rejected his doctrine. Now, I want you to put on your prophetic hat. We all want to be prophets, right? Put on your prophetic hat. What happened to Semmelweis? Well, if you're going to give it a television ending, what happened is Semmelweis overcame all the objections, and soon the scientific community turned around and accepted his teachings. And after a while, they named hospitals and clinics after him. He probably received many prestigious medical awards and recognition, right? And was probably hailed as the father of this new technique. That's what you would think would happen. What actually happened? The years of controversy gradually undermined his spirit. In 1865, he suffered a breakdown and was taken to a mental hospital where he died. Ironically, his illness and death were caused by the infection of a wound on his right hand, apparently the result of an operation he had performed before being taken ill. He died of the same disease against which he had struggled all his professional life. Wash your hands. Semmelweis' doctrine was subsequently accepted, he's dead in the grave, by medical science. His influence on the development of knowledge and control of infection was held by Joseph Lister. Ever heard of Listerine? Joseph Lister, the father of modern antiseptics. Quote, I think with the greatest admiration of him and his achievement, and it fills me with joy that at last he has given the respect due to him. Scientists, brethren and friends, are extremely biased. They don't want to change. They don't want to change. Now I asked you, I said, does evolution affect you? You probably say, no. I'm not in high school anymore. It doesn't affect me. I'd like to read you a couple of articles. One is out of this magazine here. It's called Time. Time magazine. It's published in May 8, 2000, and the title is What Mother Nature Teaches Us About Motherhood. And I'd like to read you what it says. What Mother Nature Teaches Us About Motherhood. With squalling infants in tow, she works back-breaking shifts as long as 17 hours a day to feed her growing family. Then she drags herself home, where she is greeted by her equally demanding older children who expects her to referee the squabbles as they roughhouse and play. When the kids finally fall asleep, she has only a few hours to eat, clean up, and grab some shut-eye before the sun rises, and she must do it all again. Typical working mom? No. Wild baboon living in the plains of Kenya. I have the picture here of the mother in the tree. That's what evolution wants to do. It wants to put you up in the tree. And if you don't believe that, let me keep reading. For scientists studying the business of parenting, parting the curtain on the animal world helps explain not only how mothering strategies work, but how they sometimes break down. Do you know that scientists are looking at what animals do to their children to try to understand why we sometimes kill our children? You know, I think about events in the last couple of years, about women drowning their children in bathtubs, about other women running their children into ponds in their car, about women having babies in the restroom and then going back out to the prom. Let me read you what it says here. Maybe you'll understand why that is happening. For scientists studying the business of parenting, parting the curtain on the animal world helps explain not only how mothering strategies work, but also how they sometimes break down. Confused teens aren't the only mothers who abandon their babies. You see, we're only animals. Other mammals do it too. We're the highest of the mammals, according to evolution. Parents may recoil when a Susan Smith drowns her sons in a South Carolina pond, but scientists routinely observe infanticidal animals, apparently driven by similarly dark demons, committing similarly dark acts. Now, what do the scientists base this information on? What are they basing it on? If an impulse to commit infanticide is indeed part of our genetic legacy, did you catch that? In other words, if the apes in Africa kill their children, and we're simply descended from the apes, in order to understand why we're doing it, we got to study the apes. If an impulse to commit infanticide is indeed part of our genetic legacy, can it be forgiven? Or does such a crime remain a crime no matter how strong the primal drives behind it? Anthropologists take the long view. You know, they didn't ask the ministers. They didn't ask people involved in the penal system. They didn't ask social workers. They asked anthropologists. This is Time magazine, read by everybody, probably read by you without you even thinking about it. Does evolution affect you? I think we have to re-examine the harsh penalties we place on young, uneducated women who abandon infants, says anthropologist Helen Fishers of Rutgers University. They were dancing to primitive natural rhythms and they got out of sync. Just what distinguishes the higher species of primates from the very highest one? It's not always clear, but one of the most important differences seems to be the delight humans take in challenging their primitive urges and even flat out denying them. Hardy, another anthropologist, writes that when her children were babies, this is kind of funny, but it's kind of sad too. She often cooed to them in nonsensical endearments that were oddly evocative of food. Sweet potato, muffin, cutie pie, she would call them. I could eat you up, she'd gush. Why she chose these words to babble, she couldn't say, but after a period of what she calls Darwinian self-analysis, she realized that she might be actually hearing the echoes of some genetic programming buried deep within the carnivorous parts of her brain. You wonder why young girls and women, and I'm not singling out the women because men are just as ruthless and vicious, why they do the things they do? It's okay, ladies, to do that. Because after all, we're all only animals. We're only the highest of the primates. I'd like to read you another article. And please forgive me for reading, but I need to do this because I need to drive these points home. This is in Newsweek. Another very common publication. This is published in August 14th, a few months after the one I just read you. August 14th, year 2000. It's entitled Sex and the Single Fly. And you know where I'm going with this one already, don't you? Sex and the Single Fly. And here, this is published under Society. The other one was published under Science. But here it has the chimpanzees, and it has the hyenas, the mayflies, the penguins, and what I term the single babes right here in the middle. I think this is from one of the television programs. But let me read you what it says about this. And think about this. How routinely, Sex and the Single Fly, how routinely once they started looking, biologists found promiscuous females in some 70% of the species they studied. If the animal world is very promiscuous, ladies and men, guess what that gives you permission to do? 70% of the species they studied. A clutch of grasshopper eggs can have several fathers. 35% of baby indigo buntings are sired by a male other than the guy mom came in with. And it goes on to give all these statistics of promiscuity in the animal world. Which brings us to the central question. What do females get out of promiscuity? No, besides that, I'm quoting. One benefit of polyandry, in other words, one wife or one female, many males, one benefit of polyandry is increased resources and protection from female and her brood. In other words, girls, it's okay to play around, because if you play around and you have a lot of suitors, your children are going to be healthier. You think I'm making that up? Notice what it says right here in the caption. Sex in the city. For women, playing around can bring them more resources as well as healthier kids. Comes right out of Darwinism. And young girls read that. So do some mature women read that. And they decide that it's okay to be promiscuous. Because after all, we're only animals. I'd like to read you another quote. This was published the same month as the others. This is a little different source. This is out of the Good News magazine. This was published in July, August of 2000. And there's an article in here called, Have You Performed Your Vow Today? It's on page 26. And it's written by Mr. Dave Trabig. I gave the seminar in his church area a few weeks back and about a year and a half ago. And it says, Have you performed your vow today? I want you to contrast the difference in attitude between the articles I've just read you and this one here on page 27. Marriage and commitment, this is a subheading under Have you performed your marriage vow? Have you performed your vow today? When we understand that marriage is a covenant, Malachi 2:14, that understanding should have a positive impact on the longevity of our relationship with a husband and a wife. Though we commonly speak of exchanging marriage vows, many forget the three-party covenant involved in marriage. They lose sight of the fact that the marriage covenant is a solemn agreement that includes not only one's mate, but God himself. You know why there's such a contrast between this article here out of the Good News and the ones I've read you? Because this article's ideas come out of this book. And this book's ideas don't change with whatever society's preaching at the time. 80 years ago, ladies, it was scientifically proved that you should not be able to vote. The Bible says that there's no male, no female, no slave, that we're all the same. Which one are you going to believe? And it's the same in a lot of other subjects. The Bible is not based on man's theories. Man's theories change depending on the mood of society at the time. When I was growing up and I was 14, it was a crime to have an abortion. Now it's a choice. Let's go to the book of Genesis. With that as a background, let's go to the book of Genesis. I often tell people that scientists are extremely biased, and they really don't believe me. And if you do any kind of scientific reading, if you follow any kind of science, you know it's a fact. Genesis chapter 1. And I'm going to give you a little background about the Genesis account, and we're going to look at some things, kind of set the stage for some of the concepts that we'll be learning later on today in the seminar. Genesis chapter 1. The thing that you have to notice about Genesis chapter 1 is that Genesis chapter 1 is a recreation account. It's very important that you understand that. Notice Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the earth. The proper translation for Genesis chapter 1, verse 2 is that the earth had become formless and empty. It was not created that way. It became that way. God created the heavens and the earth. You can read in the book of Job where the angels of God shouted for joy when it came into existence. So the angels predated the creation of the earth. And then through time, the earth was corrupted and it became a dump. I term it a celestial dump. And God had to recreate the earth in 6 days, as it reads here from Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 and verse 2 on. The word there, where the earth was, should be translated, the earth became, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It's the same word where it says, and man became a living soul. That word became is the same one that's used here. It's the Hebrew word haya, H-A-Y-A-H. It can mean became or was, depending on the context. And the context here shows that the earth was created before, it fell into ruin and destruction, and then God recreated the earth. Now, the question becomes this. Is the Bible scientific? Well, let's look at some things. If there was a past history of the earth, and the earth has been destroyed, is there celestial evidence of the destruction of the earth from a scientific point of view? Let me give you some things to think about. If the earth was originally created perfect and became desolate, we should have evidence for it. A couple of things to think about. Notice the solar system. Now, you look at the solar system and you look at Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, all the planets, the evening star, Mercury, and Venus, and you see them coursing through the solar system, and you think of exacting precision. That's not exactly true. There are some things that have happened to the solar system. One is the craters on the moon. Think about the craters on the moon. The craters on the moon are caused by objects 10 to 20 kilometers in diameter pummeling the moon, going probably 15 to 20 miles per second. That's not happening now. The Earth, the moon, is scar-covered with craters. What did that? How about the rings of Saturn, the rings of Uranus, the rings of Neptune, the rings of Jupiter? All of those planets have rings around them. Where did the rings come from? The rings are ground up little particles from a moon that existed, and it was ground to pieces. It got perturbed out of its orbit, got too close to one of the planets, and was ground to a pulp because of Roach's Law. Why did that happen? It's simply the leftovers of a ground-up planet. How about a Miranda, Uranus's smaller moon? If you take Miranda, it was photographed by Voyager 2 in 1986. You take Miranda, it looks like somebody got a peach. You know, you get a peach and you can just twist it in half and you can pull out the pit. Well, it looks like somebody took Miranda and just tore it in half and then gravity pulled it back together. What did that? The asteroid belt. You got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto. every 33 miles, according to Bode's law, you're going to have a planet that takes up residence there because of gravitational laws. So you got the Sun, 33 million miles. You got Mercury, another 33 million miles at 66 million miles. You have Venus, another 33 million miles at 93 million miles. You got the Earth, another 33 million miles at 120 million miles. You got Mars. At another 33 million miles, you got a big empty space full of chunks of rocks. There was a planet there that was destroyed. What destroyed it? What ground up that planet and made the asteroid belt? How about the orbit of Pluto? Orbit of Pluto, you got the outer planet, and Pluto's orbit comes in every 100 years. Pluto's got an orbit of about 300 years. It takes 300 years to go around the Sun, as opposed to our 1 year. So every 100 years or so, Pluto comes in closer to the Sun. Why? What perturbed Pluto out of its orbit? The whole solar system has scars of planetary catastrophes. We don't see them because we're not looking for them, but they're there. You know, the Bible says that Satan fell. It says, who may have? Lord, don't shake your head. But you may have. And if you have, the furniture gets knocked around and things get broken. The Bible says that Satan fell and that there was a war in heaven, and he led a third of the angels into rebellion. The evidence for it is all over the solar system. The solar system supports the fact that the earth was created, fell into ruin and destruction, and the angels, the demons, led a rebellion and there was war in heaven. The evidence is all over the solar system. The creation account, point number three. Second point is that there's a recreation account in Genesis 1. Third point is that the creation account agrees with the geological evidence and other laws of science. Let me give you an example. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In verse 2 it says, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. How many times has the earth been covered by water? Oh, we're going to hear a seminar this afternoon about Noah's Ark and the flood. Oh, yeah, okay, Genesis chapter 6, 7, and 8, Noah's flood, you're right. But it's also mentioned in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. It says that the earth was covered by water. The earth has been covered by water twice. That's what the Bible says. Do you know that this perfectly agrees with the geological evidence? Think about it. There was two periods of earth-wide geologic flooding. The first included the Mesozoic, Paleozoic, and Precambrian eras, which included the Devonian period, called the Age of Fishes, because millions upon millions of fish fossils are found. And scientists say at this time the earth was covered by water. It agrees perfectly with Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. And then what else? The second included portions of the Cenozoic era, which included the Pleistocene epoch. We sometimes call those the Ice Ages. The Pleistocene epoch corresponds to the Ice Ages. The Ice Ages correspond to the flooding and change of climate after the flood. Just on a general cursory summation, the geological evidence agrees with what the Bible says. We're going to be talking more about that in the seminar later this afternoon. Let's look at Genesis chapter 1, and let's look at the account in a little more detail. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth had become formless and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So he cleared the atmosphere and light appeared, because he'd already created the sun and the moon and the stars earlier in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. So he's simply reformulating the atmosphere. And that becomes very important when you look at radiometric dating, carbon-14 dating, potassium-argon dating, and uranium-to-lead dating. There were certain things that happened in the atmosphere here in Genesis chapter 1, verse 3. Because the light was able to penetrate the atmosphere where before it wasn't. And God saw the light, it was good, verse 4, and God divided the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the first day occurs. Then God said, let there be a firmament in heaven, and we're going to just kind of skim some of the things. But in verse 9 it says, let the waters under the heaven be gathered together in one place, and he caused a dry land to appear. Verse 10, and God saw that it was good. Verse 11, the earth brings forth the vegetation. Verse 12, more vegetation is brought forth, and God saw that it was good in the end of verse 12. Verse 13, a third day comes and goes. Verse 14, God said, then let there be light in the firmament of heaven to divide the night, day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons for days and years, and let them be for light in the firmament of heaven to give light on the earth. And it was so. Then God made to appear, as it should read in the Hebrew, made to appear two great lights. The greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He, and if you notice, the made is in italics. He, the stars also. So the stars existed from Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. He simply caused them to appear here and to be for signs and for seasons and for the various calculations of the calendar. God set them in the firmament to give light on the earth, to rule over the day. Verse 18, it was good. Then God said, let the waters abound with the abundance of living creatures. So he creates all the sea creatures. He recreates them. He creates the sea creatures once again. And God saw that it was good in verse 21. And God blessed them. And he creates the birds on the earth. And the evening and the morning were the fifth day. Then God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures according to its kind. Very interesting. Cattle according to their kind. Birds according to their kind. Vegetation according to its kind. Everything is brought forth according to its kind. Verse 25. And God made the beasts of the earth according to its kind, cattle according to its kind, and everything that creeps on the earth according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. Let's keep your place there in Genesis. Let's go to Colossians. I asked you at the beginning of my sermon, where did we come from? Let's look at Colossians. Colossians, chapter 1. Verse 15, he is Christ, as the context shows. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For by Christ all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. You have X-rays going through this room. You have cosmic rays going through this room. You have microwave radiation going through this room. You have radio waves going through this room. That's why you put your set of headphones on and hear where you're at. You don't see them. Do they exist? Yes. You don't see all those electromagnetic waves, but they exist as surely as this table or as this podium exists. And it says here, for by him, verse 16, all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. Evolution begins with a law of gravity working. Evolution begins with the first, second law of thermodynamics working. Evolution begins with the chemical laws working. Evolution begins with the electromagnetic radiation working. Evolution begins with all these laws working. Where did they come from? All things were created by him, whether visible or invisible. Can you see the law of gravity? Can you see gravity? No. Does it work? It does. It does. You don't see it. Somebody created it. Verse 17. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church. Notice John chapter 1. John. Not 1 John, but John chapter 1. John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So we have a being that was with God at the beginning. He was called the Word, and he was also God. So we have two beings at the beginning. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. Everything that we see has been made by the Word. In him was life, and life was the light of men. Does it take more faith to believe in evolution that says you have descended from rocks? Or does it take more faith to believe that you were created by something that has life in it? There's a law in science called the law of biogenesis. It says that only living things can produce living things, or only life can come from life, if you look at it from the other point of view. Evolution violates that law. Evolution says you've come from rocks. I remember having a conversation with an evolutionary friend once at college, and he said, "You don't believe in evolution?" I said, "No." And I said, "Why not?" And I said, "I don't have as much faith as you have." And he goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "I don't believe we've come from rocks." He said, "Well, I don't believe we've come from rocks." And I go, "Yes, you do." And he goes, "No, I don't." I said, "Okay, let me ask you a question." I said, "Where did man come from?" "Well, man came from Homo erectus and Australopithecus africanus and afarensis." "Okay. Well, where did these Australopithecus come from?" "Well, they came from the pre-ape men." "Okay, where did they?" "Well, they descended from the mammals, the pre-mammals." "Where did the pre-mammals come from?" "Well, they came from the fishes." "Okay, where did the fishes come from?" "Well, they came from the multicelled organisms in the sea." I said, "Okay, where did the multicelled organisms in the sea come from?" "Well, they came from the single-celled organisms in the sea." I said, "Okay, where did the single-celled organisms in the sea come from?" "Well, they came from this biotic soup that was in the oceans, you know, billions and billions of years ago, and lightning struck and imparted the energy to produce life." I said, "Okay, where did this biotic soup come from?" He said, "Well, the waters washed over the rocks." And he looked at me and he said, "Never mind." You see, I don't have that much faith. I believe that I have come from something living, which is what science teaches. That's a fundamental law of science. And it says right here in verse 4, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men." That agrees perfectly with science. We get intimidated by science, evolutionary science. And it requires more faith to believe in evolution than it does to believe the Bible. Verse 5, "And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. This man came for a witness, to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. He was not that light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man coming into the world. He, Christ, was in the world. The world was made through him, and the world did not know him." Think about that concept, brethren and friends. God stooped down, created Adam out of red dirt, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Adam, Chaya, became a living soul, and he came back, and the people he created did not recognize him. How'd you like to be the producer, the inventor of a new type of machine that maybe was able to create energy? And you went to a physics convention, and nobody recognized you. They didn't believe what you said, even though everyone was using the machine. That's what we've done to Christ when we believe in evolution. We've denied him his rightful place as a creator. Verse 14. "And the world became, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, of the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, 'This is he of whom I said, he who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me.'" Many times in the church we say, if I could just tell people and give them the right kind of words, they would understand what I believe. And there is a time and place to do that. But I want you to consider something. It says here that Jesus Christ came to his own did not receive him. He was truth in the flesh. Pilate has Christ standing 4 feet from him. And Pilate says, "What's truth? You got truth in the flesh next to Pilate, and Pilate does not believe him." They're not going to believe you and me either, unless God is working with them. And we all think, we sometimes think, not, you know, we have this concept that, you know, if I can just sort of explain it to my brother-in-law, or to my cousin, or to the guy that I work with, they'll understand. They didn't believe Christ. How much less are they going to believe us? There's a miracle that has to take place in your mind and my mind. And I don't think in the church we realize how unique we are. Our children are taught that they have descended from the mammals, the lower mammals, and we hear all of this stuff I've been reading about, and we forget that we are special. And I'm here to remind you of that. We forget that, because evolution robs us of that. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. And we left off reading in verse 25. We were going to begin to read in verse 26 of Genesis chapter 1. What did the fish produce? Fish. What did the vegetation produce? Vegetation. What did the flying birds produce? After their kind. What did the seeds produce? After its kind. The book of Genesis is very specific. Everything is created after its kind. Dogs bring forth dogs. Cats bring forth cats. You don't get a dog, you don't get a cog. You get a dog or a cat. Everything brings forth after its kind. Notice verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." Who have we been patterned after? Who are we modeled after? The answer is so obvious that I'm not even going to answer that. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Give you something to think about. Maybe a little speculation, but maybe not. The earth existed before man existed. You have the four living creatures. Eagle, ox, lion. They represent the three divisions of the animal world, flying, domestic animals, and the wild animals. King of the eagles, king of the lions, ox or a bull is the king of the domesticated animals. They're angelic creatures. They're on the throne of God, and they have wings, and you can read about them in Ezekiel and in the book of Revelation. The animal world has been patterned after what? The angelic world. God is over the angels. We are now over the animals. We've been given dominion over them in Genesis chapter 1. There's an analogy there. If you can see it, there's an analogy there. And what does it say here in verse 27? So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and multiply." We have been created after the God kind. What did the vegetation bring forth? Vegetation. What did the birds bring forth? Birds. What did the sea creatures bring forth? Sea creatures. What is God going to bring forth? The Bible says that you and I are sons of God. Evolution is not scientific because it violates many, many laws of science. Let me just give you a rundown of them. Let's go first to 1 Timothy. Let's go to 1 Timothy. You know, people, young people, and I work with young people, I have 380 students left. 380 students. I work with young people all the time. And I can relate to how they think, I think. And it's very interesting. Young people, especially in the church, say, "Oh, you just don't understand." You see, we're living in a society where evolution is taught, where all these cultural, in the cultural context that we live in, it's very difficult to remain true. All these scientific discoveries being made that seem to deny the Bible its rightful place, etc., etc. Let me read you something in 1 Timothy. Go to 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 6. Timothy. Father was a Greek, mother and grandmother believers, Lois and Eunice. He was a minister, young minister in the church. Verse 20 of 1 Timothy 6. "O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust." Somebody committed to Timothy something. Parents, somebody taught Timothy. "O Timothy, guard what was committed to your trust, avoiding the profane and idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge." Or some translations say science, or other translations say philosophy. The theory of evolution is not new. It's just been dressed up again. You know, we often read about the old immorality. Old immorality is the same. Morality has always been around. Humans have always been around. Evolution has just simply been put into scientific language now. It predates, it goes all the way back to when men were created. They came up with alternate ideas of how they got here. Notice, idle babblings and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge, by professing it, some have strayed concerning the faith. It really saddens me to find that there are young people who will look to science and say, you know, I believe science more than I believe the Bible. Because actually it takes less faith to believe the scriptures. It takes more faith to believe that you've come from something non-living. It takes more faith to believe that all the design you see is a matter of chance. And you've got to try hard not to believe. Some of the laws that it violates, the laws of genetics. Remember Gregor Mendel? The pea pods and the pea leaves and the little peas inside the pods and the color of the pea flowers. You know what Gregor Mendel discovered? He discovered that kind produces kind. That's what he discovered. He discovered that within certain laws, kinds produce kinds. Creatures reproduce after the kind. Evolution says, no, creatures are changing through time. Hard science does not show that. Hard science, the laws of heredity show that things within a certain variation remain stable for, and I use millions in quotes, for millions of years. You have roaches that are 60 million years old and they look identical to the ones we have now. Ants, dragonflies, all kinds of living creatures. Laws of mutations. Evolution says that we are mutating our genetic material and slowly changing. 99.999, and add about another four nines after that, of all mutations are bad. I'm going to be flying tomorrow back to Texas. I do not want to get on an airplane that has a 99.99% chance of something going wrong with it. Would you? But yet, scientists tell us that's what changes our genetic material. In actuality, mutations, a large percentage of them, are lethal to the organism. Laws of hybridization. Horse and a donkey mate, you produce a mule. Why? The kind is being violated. You're getting close to the kind boundaries. You can't mate a dog and a cat. You can't mate a giraffe and an elephant. You can't do that. It doesn't work. Laws of biogenesis. Living things only come from living things. And dead things cannot produce anything living. You go home. You open your refrigerator. You get out that glass of milk. You pour that glass of milk. You get yourself a couple of three or four chocolate chip cookies. You drink that milk. That milk has been pasteurized. It's been sterilized. That might be good or bad, depending on your point of view. But it's dead. And because it's dead, nothing grows in it. Every time you get a glass of milk, you're violating the premise of evolution, which says that dead things can produce living things. No, they do not. And they never have. That was discovered by Louis Pasteur in the 1800s. Pasteurization, Pasteur. He was actually looking at ways to make wine keep from becoming cloudy and smelly. It was actually growing microorganisms. So he pasteurized it, he heated it. And therefore, the wine remained clear for many, many years. It's called pasteurization. Second law of thermodynamics. Batteries running out of your flashlight. You got to put gas in your car. We're wearing down. Clean your room. It means the same thing. Things are degenerating. Except for the theory of evolution. Evolution says, no, things are getting better. It is the only tenet in science that says that. And it is allowed to say that because if it's not correct, evolution cannot proceed. So it violates the second law of thermodynamics. The universe is running down. Romans chapter 8. Romans chapter 8. Verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. There's going to be a glory revealed in us. For the earnest expectation of the creation or the universe eagerly Eagerly what? Waits for the revealing of the sons of God. The universe is waiting for something. What's it waiting for? It's waiting for us. People look forward to Christ's return. Christ is a return. The millennium is going to be set up. I look for that too, but I look forward 1,000 years after that. You know, there's been 2 millenniums since Christ has come, and we killed him. It's been 2,000 years. Millennium is simply Greek for 1,000 years. Spanish is mil años. Millennium. There's been 2 millennia that are coming gone. Millennia's going to come and it's going to be gone. Feast of Tabernacles, how long last? It's gone. Millennia's going to come and go. What's going to happen after that? Let's keep reading. Verse 19, for the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. The universe is under the second law of thermodynamics, which means it's losing energy. It's in a state of decay. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemptions of our bodies. The universe is going to be delivered from its bondage of decay. We have some role in that. We are going to make Star Wars look like tiddlywinks when you really think about it. They take an astronaut. They train him or her. They put her in a life. They put the astronaut in a life support system. They show him how to go to the bathroom. They show him how to breathe. They show him how to eat. They train him underwater in these big tanks with divers all around him, make sure he doesn't drown, and weightlessness. And then they put him on top of a rocket, and they put megatons of explosive material behind him, and they blast him up into outer space. And he goes up there, and he finds a satellite, snatches it, takes the battery pack out, and replaces it. Train 6-7 years to do that. I do that in my driveway in about 20 minutes. What is the best... If you were going to design an organism that could travel through space, that never grew hungry, that didn't need any energy, that had its own life support system, that didn't need oxygen, that didn't need to eat, what would you design? I would design a spirit being. The universe is waiting for us, brother. Evolution says that when you die, that's it. But the universe is waiting for us. Let's notice Genesis chapter 2. Adam and Eve had a problem. You know what Adam and Eve's problem was? You know, I coordinate several lab sections, do all kinds of experiments. I coordinate all kinds of lab sections, do experiments. And the experiments, I can tell you how they're going to fall out, how they're going to work, because I understand about the laws of chemistry, understand about the laws of thermodynamics. And Adam and Eve, what they did is they did what I do in the lab. They used their human reasoning to figure out whether they should eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Eve saw the fruit. It looked good. She could hear it rustling in the breeze. Sounded good. She could smell it. Smells great. You know, she reached up there to touch it. It wasn't a prickly pear. It felt good and she plucked it. And then she ate it. She didn't spit it out. She swallowed it. And then she gave to her husband. And he ate too. There's one thing wrong. God told her not to do it. There was a spiritual aspect that she left out. You mean to tell me if I give 10% of my income that I will actually be blessed as if I have more? Uh-huh. You mean it's more blessed to give than to receive? Uh-huh. You mean it's better to treat people the way I want to be treated than just to be selfish? Uh-huh. Those are spiritual laws. You can't measure those. You mean it's better if I take one day out of the week, the seventh day, the Sabbath, and I keep that to honor you? Uh-huh. Why? Because I'm telling you to. Adam and Eve left that part out. They did exactly what scientists do all the time, and they left the main part out, which is obedience to God and being understanding his spiritual intent, and you know what the result is? They're going to die, and they died, and we're dying with them. Scientific philosophy, to its ultimate end, leads to death unless it's coupled with spiritual knowledge. And this world is great at the first and bad at the second. This is the same, the technique that Adam and Eve used for the fruit is the same technique that is used by science today to prove that there is no need for a creator. The scientific method is a method that has given us the acceptance of abortions, homosexuality, infidelity. I have read psychological journal articles written by scientists that say, play around a little bit, it'll spice up your marriage. Infidelity and animalistic behavior. After all, if we descended from the animals, just act like them. I'd like to read you a couple of quotes out of a couple of textbooks that I used when I was in college. This is out of Vertebrate Life, written by H. Poe in 1996, published by Prentice Hall. Humans are great apes, close relatives of chimpanzees and gorillas, and much of the biology of humans is best understood in the context of our vertebrate heritage. You want to know what you're like? Study the apes. That's why they pay this woman millions of dollars, National Geographic, millions of dollars, to go to Africa and study apes, because it's shedding light on us. But what if we're not descended from apes? Another one, Mammalogy, by T. Vegan, 1986, published by HBJ Company. And this is very interesting. You see, we're not here because there's a creator. We're not here because God is creating sons of God. We're here because, as the quote here says, how very different would have been the vast sweep of post-Triassic vertebrate evolution, and how altered would be the face of the earth today, if the little late Triassic mammals had proven vulnerable to some contemporary reptilian predator and had relinquished the scene completely to the reptiles. In other words, the only reason you're here is because when we talked about the rocks and we went back to those little mammals were able to escape the dinosaurs that were trying to eat them and evolve into you. That's the only reason you're here. God created us. We are the children of God. We were not created by some unintelligent process through a random set of circumstances. God created our parents, Adam and Eve. Eve means the mother of all things. God created everything. We are the children of God physically now, and later we're going to be the spiritual sons of God. God is our Father. Not evolution. Why does the world have so many problems? They don't know their origins. They don't know where they've come from. And if you don't know where you've come from, you certainly don't know where you're going.